Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking Tar Spot, our second take on Tar Spot as a full episode. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at the battle for milk supply. Egg History Minute, we'll talk about the Wisconsin milk strikes of 1933. Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events, and we'll wrap it all up with a Feel Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. All right. It's been the preseason has started. And, I don't generally put a whole lot of stock into preseason, but right now we're sitting at 500 on the preseason, and was not a very good game this last weekend, but it was also their starters against our everything else.
So Bill, you've seen a lot of football where you've got like a JV type of team playing a JV3 or it's just preseason football is why we put any information in it at all is
because all these analytic guys haven't had anything to do for about 5 months and now they
the crazy part about the Broncos game with the Packers was the Broncos were trying to do one thing and the Packers were trying to do a completely opposite thing, and it just didn't seem like it made any sense. Like, it felt like Peyton was trying to be better than it, like, I don't know, it just
he was trying to win the preseason.
Yeah, he's trying to be Sean Payton again. It's like, dude, just
was there bounty gate going on? Was something like
felt
that?
Really? Stuff like that. Yeah. Like,
sure.
Really, you're gonna play your starters for a quarter and a half while we play our, like you said, Matt, everybody else, and you think this isn't doing anything for anybody, right? Like, you can't evaluate our guys because they're getting their butt kicked.
Yeah,
it's not even the same. So, I didn't turn on at all. I was listening and then kind of got out of hand, and I'm like, "Oh, this is."
I forgot it was even on. Oh. I thought I read the wrong score because there was a final score of 2 points that, like,
a safety in like late in the third or early fourth quarter. No, I was going to turn it on, and then I happened to like glance at my phone and saw the score. I'm like, no. It was like at that point, it was 23 to nothing or something like that. So I was like, that doesn't seem like it's going to be worthwhile.
It feels like preseason football used to be the appetizer. Like, you're going out for a steak dinner, and you're, like, real excited about the steak, and the appetizer comes, you're like, this will be good, or maybe the salad bar at a supper club. You're like, this is good, but you're really waiting for the steak.
Right.
Now, it does not feel like that at all. It feels like the junky bread you might get that's half stale thrown in front of you at a restaurant where you're just like, this isn't even worth. Not that it's not worth watching, but maybe part of it is all this other new football that we'll get, like in the spring, like what are those USFL and
USFL and XFL,
those
merged.
Yes, so those leagues, not that that's good football, but at least when you watch that, it feels
it's the same
caliber of player again. Yeah. Where this, like you say, is just like you said, what are we even watching here? What are you trying to do? What's going on? Why is this team only have a safety the whole game?
Yeah,
it's like football is getting the minor leagues. Like if you go to either the Timber Rattlers, which are probably closer to pros than like the Green Bay Rockers, where it's guys that are college-ish, like we play in college, but we're also going to play like on the side type thing. That's your spring football league, is like the guys who want to play in the NFL someday. Sometimes you get a little bit of movement both ways. Guys that don't hack it in the NFL go back, or some of these guys may someday play in the NFL. But
you're surprised. You're right, Matt. It is like that because surprise, there's not like an unwritten rule. I mean, there's an unwritten rule probably, but it seems like it's going way of, we're going to play our starters for 2 series. And so then both teams kind of do that.
Right.
And then maybe one team changes a little later. Now it's not like that. And it's not good. It's not good.
Yeah. No, it is definitely more. It's more the NFL wants it than even the teams want it. Because that's been the debate ever since they started adding games to the season. You know, we went from 16 to 17.
And we know that, too. The 18 is coming here soon.
18 will be here soon.
Yeah. Maybe that's part of it. They're almost making the product so bad so that us as fans are like, yes,
we want that.
Thank you for making this 18th game because
they're going to take a preseason game away.
Yeah.
Right.
Two preseason games. You get one home, one away, probably. And then your 18 regular seasons. They just got to figure that out if you're getting two buys or what you're doing.
What I also think is wild is how many of these like co-practices they're doing now. Yeah. And if you just remember, not that far as like our practices are so like fairly secret and they want to try to keep that all separate. And now it's like, hey, come in our practice place. And we're all like, it's just coming more common too.
Well, they're saying the argument is the coaches have more control over like trying to probably to prevent injuries, right? Like,
right.
Because I think during the Broncos one, the Love's arm got hit in some.
Yeah,
like,
during a game, you're not going to.
Yeah,
prevent,
but like.
In a practice scenario,
like,
you can.
And, LaFleur must have just lit the defense up. Like, this is our quarterback. Like, you can't do that. This is the point of these. Like, and you're not going to do that in a game, but in this practice scenario, maybe the coaches feel they have more control.
Yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see when 18th game does come, what the preseason really turns into, and I wouldn't be surprised if they just go to more like inter-team scrimmages,
yes,
rather than actual games. Because that too, like, you're obviously not going to try your trick plays and all the other stuff that you're going to use in the season, but at least you're not just running against your own guys all the time, and I could see the value in that of. Yeah, well, they know our playbook, so they know how to counter all our plays. Let's see what a guy doesn't know.
That was the argument at the game on Sunday night, was that Halfley ran like three defensive plays. There was talk of that. Like, he didn't do anything. So, okay, so you have three basic coverages. You're not trying to pressure the quarterback. You're not trying to put any pressure on anybody. Well, yeah, they're going to go up and down the field.
Is it as bad as the Pro Bowl yet?
Not that bad.
No, that's what I thought too. But it's bad. It's maybe like the NBA All-Star game bad, where you're just like, what, you know, like there's no defense.
Or it's just a shoot around.
Yeah.
Well, the only difference is you've got guys that are playing that don't have a roster spot in the books, right? Like the guys that
are trying to get a spot.
Right. Yeah, the guys that aren't playing the guys that aren't playing have a roster spot. They don't care. They don't want to play, but a lot of these guys don't have a spot, so they're trying to play. They're just not playing anything that looks like football because they don't want anybody to get hurt.
Right. It'll be a hard way to play for a roster spot and still make sure nobody gets hurt.
Flag preseason.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's two-hand touch, guys. Stop shoving each other.
I'm surprised
they
haven't.
That's the Pro Bowl, man.
Yeah, I know.
I'm surprised they haven't gotten to where you read the red helmet. The quarterback red helmet in a preseason game where you can't touch them. I'm surprised they haven't gone to that just because those are so. If your quarterback gets hurt,
JJ McCarthy went.
Right.
Whoops.
Which, for them too, you're trying to see how good he is and what you got, so you got to play him.
That was one thing with Love last year. We were lucky that.
Yep.
Because that, out of it, yeah, he played well and they made the playoffs and they beat Dallas, all that. But I mean, it was a half a season, right? But you think you got your guy. They think they got their guy, but they don't know if they got their guy yet because he hasn't done anything. So at least we got a season to see what our guy could do.
All right. You guys ready to talk tar spot? All right. It's been three-ish years since our last big tar. We've talked about tar spot a number of times. But we had a whole episode kind of dedicated to the discussion of tar spot about 3 years ago. Call it Tar Spotter. It's one of our more popular episodes that's been downloaded. And so this week we've got take two on that. So back then it was still relatively new. We didn't necessarily know a lot. But maybe we knew more than we thought we did.
Surprised listening back to that episode and reading our notes from the episode. The episode notes, we did know more than I thought we knew. So that was kind of neat to think back.
Like, how much has really changed,
right?
Too, right?
That was a good way to say it, right? it just was so new at the time that it was quite, I don't know if it's too soon to use the COVID analogy or not. Matt, is it too soon?
Yeah.
So it feels like looking back at that episode, it was early on COVID time where, you know, when you saw cases rising, but it was still only like 1,000 cases in the U.S. and you're like, oh my God, this is so bad. And then when it got real bad and you're right in the middle of it, and it was like the whole like 2 week thing to stop it. Like that's where we were at that episode.
We thought in 2 weeks it would be done.
Right. And it wasn't. And yeah,
it's never going to be done.
Now it does seem like it's, I'm not saying that again, it's never going to be done. You're right. Way to say, we'll always have tar spot. We'll always try to be battling. Our varieties have gotten better. We've gotten better at scouting for it, all that. So
that's probably one thing, Todd, we did learn that year, though, is what varieties handled it better.
Oh, right.
Right?
Yeah.
And
right. Certain, that's the biggest change.
Good point. Certain genetics did.
Since then is, yeah, having actual ratings.
Looking back then, one company, NK, had ratings. So some of the Syngenta stuff. But everyone else was just basically had a very loose, I wouldn't even call it a rating, and was like, well, we know what ones are, you know, they didn't know which ones were necessarily bad, but they knew which ones maybe could handle it a little better than the others. That's it. And yes, some varieties that year got totally train wrecked.
The interesting part that you might see different maybe than like with, it may be similar, but with white mold, we think about, you know, more rainfalls and more being wet all the time. Where this is, you need wetness, but then you need a dry cycle too. You need this intermittent, is what I kept reading when you talk about this, is intermittent wet dry cycles. And these, we've had really humid days. And in fact, I went back in August so far, and we got a week to go, but there's only been 4 days in August so far in Wisconsin that the average relative humidity has been under 75%. And that's kind of the target, right? Right around that 75%. You get temperatures in the 60s, low 70s is kind of a key too. But then that humidity where you get that leaf wetness. And I've got our little weather station in my house, and I'll kind of just off and on look at that. And going to bed some nights, you're at 99% humidity with the dew coming on and everything there. So it's definitely been the environment to produce it. We always know that there's that disease triangle, right? Like just because the weather is there doesn't mean you're going to get it, but it's definitely right at that spot where we should be looking for it. And we have, and I think we've all found some, but this year we haven't found a big outbreak yet.
It also, if you look back to then, you know, we sprayed some fungicides, but probably not nearly the fungicide use we use now, and we got drones to spray it.
Yep.
So I would agree, one of the things I've seen is that I've, like you say, seen it out there. There's a bunch of counties that have it, but it isn't necessarily where it's just overtaking things this time in August yet, in mid-August, which is good. And part of that is picking, you know, varieties, using fungicide, doing some of that things to sort of try to keep it at bay as much as we can. So I think that part of it is exciting, that we're maybe winning the war, losing battles at times, but winning the war on it of total. Bill, when you talk weather, I think it is interesting of the temperature part. So the relative humidity is fairly humid at 75%. It likes the humidity, but the temperature, you always think of like hot, like whenever farmers think of like really bad disease days, it's always also pretty hot, mm-hmm. like in the 80s, right. Maybe not 90s, but hot, which I think is unique about this, is it actually doesn't like the 90s, 80s, it really doesn't. It likes more of a
temperate,
moderate. Yes.
Yeah, temperate disease. It likes more of the 70s.
Which I think is unique for the state we live in Wisconsin, is we are going to see more of that temperate weather than what, you know, Illinois, Iowa
right.
would see. So they might get that outbreak earlier than we get it, but it does seem that then they get hot temperatures in July that sort of seem to keep it at bay, whereas we, in late July, early August, get those temperatures that could pull in this disease.
Well, and normally, typically we would get a dry period at some point, whether it's July or early August. And this year we really never have gotten that. I think we're currently in our potentially the longest stretch we've gone without rain. There's not really much rain forecast till next week. Otherwise, we've had moisture out there. You know, just even the dews at night, like you said, Bill, been using rain gear pretty constantly throughout the month of August because there's always that kind of wet hanging on those corn plants in the morning. So,
one also thing to talk about when we're talking weather is irrigation.
Yep,
that's
right.
That's sort of your own weather. And a lot of guys like to irrigate at night, you know, and it's in general that a lot like to irrigate at night, maybe is the wrong way to say it, but it's sometimes you just flip the pivot on at night, run it through the night because it gets dewy at night anyway. So you feel like, well, no, I'm already.
You're gaining more of that.
Right. Yeah. Whereas what's odd with tar spot is the literature would suggest you're actually better off not irrigating at night, that if you can give it that break, it'll actually help it. So because it, you just want to have less water events or fewer events that way. So you might be better off irrigating starting at whenever the dew would set in. So say, I don't know what time the dew exactly sets in. It depends on the night.
It's evening.
Right.
Yeah.
But say if the dew is setting in at, you know, 3 a.m, flip it on. That would be the same, and then that leaf can dry off during the day. So just watching irrigation events. One of also things we saw with the irrigators is wherever the tracks were from the pivot, where the wheels run, it'll just knock that corn over. But where the gearboxes are, it'll just mangle up like two or three rows. And those are the rows, too, that get all full of mud. They're always really kind of dirty when you walk through a pivot track. And that's, you know, both getting more inoculum there and having that leaf, that plant that's all mangled up has an entry point. And it just seemed like we'd always, remember that, Matt, we'd always find tar spot right in those and then it would kind of infest from there. So that'd be another thing if you have a way to sort of, you know, either not plant those wheel tracks at all or mow them down.
Plant in a circle.
Right. Yeah, you know, just do whatever you can to avoid the, because like I said, it's not necessarily the wheel tracks where the gearbox are knocking it down. So, or have a way that plant just isn't there would be good. So, yeah, that's kind of the weather factor. And I think that you're right, Bill, that 75% humidity thing is a huge deal when it comes to tar spot. That a lot of these, as we look into what the forecasts in the apps that help us predict it, that's the main thing that they're looking at.
And there's a couple of ways to predict and to also see what counties have reported tar spot. The reporting part of it, if you Google IPM pipe, IPM, P-I-P-E, corn, tar spot, or something of that nature, you're going to get a map that shows all the counties in the Midwest that have tar spot. And it isn't a predictor, it's just here's where we're at. And then UW put out the Tar Spotter app a couple years ago. It sounded like the first rendition was pretty poor and didn't really give they miscalculated a lot, but it sounds like they've really fixed it and it's pretty good now. And then Field Profit is another one app. And Matt, you were looking at that before the episode here, and sounds like for Android users, you couldn't find it, but I found it on my iPhone. So, and that's similar. Man.
Yeah, that one's they favor in the iPhone again.
And that one's similar. I mean, I don't know that you're losing out by. It does give you a little chart.
No, you and I ran the same the field, the cornfield around us here at the worldwide headquarters, and we got the same number, same risk number.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know that it's
the Field Profit actually gives you like a week. Like a line graph for the week as to when the higher probability could be that you could have a higher issue.
And we're so. The green bubble, Matt.
Green bubble.
Yes, we are the text user thing where it comes in on your iPhone is the green bubble. Oh, so yeah, all the iPhone users know that we're like
Android shaming.
Yes. Yeah. So, yes, we don't get field
it's
profit.
It's sad that in 2024 this kind of bigotry is still occurring.
It's not a blue bubble.
No, we're the green bubble. But you got, Matt, you got your iPad.
I do have an iPad, which I can put
that you use quite often. Yes. So, yes.
I try to be equal opportunity when it comes to devices, but I just don't like that they do that.
I did find a really cool chart from Michigan State. Basically, and the big thing with a lot of these universities is scout, scout, scout. So it's like, we're not trying to predict to some degree, but we're trying to say, okay, we scout, we see it. Where's the corn at? Then let's spray from there.
One of the nice parts about looking for this is it is very easy to, you can't miss it with a leaf burn from a chemical or a fertilizer application or
right.
It is easy to see.
Yeah, basically distinct.
Looks like, so when you're scouting, what you're going to want to look for is black spots on the leaf. Like, that's it. And if you think it's fly poop, you
do the scratch test.
Yes.
You see if it comes off. If you can wipe it off, it's not tar spot.
A lot of time I like to spit on it and then so
give the old hock
to the hock to a on the leaf.
The hock to a boy.
Yeah.
That's not required.
No.
Unlike Todd, you don't have to spit on that thing.
It just seems like that little bit of wetness, you can scrape it off or not. So it is a disease that, like, when it first came out, there was times where we missed it for fly poop. You know, and then you figure it out. Now, in general, you kind of just know because you're used to looking at that spot and how it infects. So that is nice that it is fairly easy to just look for those black spots on a leaf. But this is a cool chart, Bill.
Yeah, basically says, like, okay, vegetative stage, tassel stage, blister, milk, goes right through the R stages and says, okay, if you're going to spray, then where are we at? And then there's a comment that says, oh, if we spray here, we're less likely to have to spray a second time. Or if we haven't sprayed, yep, we better spray. So that was kind of neat that we're kind of in that, you know, for the most point, the early season corn that was planted, we're probably what, R3, that milk stage. I don't think we're quite to dough yet.
No, but yeah, I'd say we're, for most of the early stuff is definitely in the milk stage, and so probably wouldn't need a second spray if you sprayed within the last couple stages here. What surprised me is that at VT they're still saying you might need to spray again, but that goes with, you know, fungicides not season long coverage necessarily either. I think sometimes we figure that with silage it is for the
most part. Bill, that was my question here. Do you know if this is calibrated for grain, corn?
Yeah.
Or silage corn. Yeah.
Correct.
Yep. So I think that's unique for certain situations. And Matt's right. Of if you're on a silage corn, that'd be a little different. Where,
right,
you know, you're at R3 stage, you're 2 to 3 weeks from chopping it. That you're not going to go spray and then you're just going to chop it. So that is a unique thing that would be different. But Matt's right too. A lot of times when you spray fungicide once, you just like, well, we did that. Like, I'm done now. I sprayed the fungicide.
Right.
And then if you remember back with, like, white mold, with certain fungicides, you had to do R1 and R3. Mm-hmm. And that was always a pain, if you remember the white mold, because it was like, well, no. Especially those two feel, R1 and R3 is not all that far. It's probably 2 to 3 weeks. So you feel like, well, we just did that, but you got to kind of protect more of the flowers. And with tar spot, if you have a bad infestation, you may have to.
That's one thing about this time of year is, you know, if we're in August and we're getting it on silage, it gives me less heart palpitations than I would, you know. Grain corn, obviously, it's got a longer time out in the field. It's got to get to black layer. It's got more work to do than the silage does, but it's the years when it shows up in, like, July. Then it's like, ooh, okay, this could be bad.
Well, and even where it shows up, right? If it shows up on the lower canopy, some of those leaves are getting senesced anyway.
Yep.
It's not getting the sunlight. It's not doing the photosynthesis like the ear leaf or above that is. So if we're going to chop in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever it is, and we're starting to see it in the bottom part of the plant, well, whatever, right? It's there. It's really not doing anything. And even, I think I talked to Jean someone last year, Damon or somebody, that said, like, even when we get to dough stage, at some point it's like, well, it just isn't going to do the damage at that point.
Right.
Like you said, Matt, like if it was a month prior to that.
Right.
I just was having a conversation with a grower yesterday on some fields because he's got some sort of swing acres that might be silage or might be grain.
I think there's a lot of that out there. Well, this year.
Enough of them, though, are going to go towards silage. And I was just verifying. I said, hey, we found tar spot in this field. Please don't leave it to grain. And they said, no, that wasn't the plan anyway. Yeah. So I said, great.
Yeah, plant breeders, we need you to figure out the thing that giant ragweed does with Roundup to do for corn to do with tar spot. If it's get tar spot leaves, just like cut off that leaf and
let it fall, drop off. Grow a new leaf. Sort of, yes. I like what the bottom of the chart does say, or it basically, when it says, even in years where two applications appear to prove tar spot control, improved ROI is marginal over a single well-timed application. So that, too, that you probably don't need two applications if you time the one application correctly. And that's where going back to those apps, you know, scouting and then using Tar Spotter, because me and Matt can't use Field Profit, but using Tar Spotter has been helpful to time, because I know right, like at, you get to sort of that right ahead of that late vegetative stage where you're like, well, shoot, should we spray right now or Tassel or R1? And if you run Tar Spotter those weeks, there was a couple times in there where I ran and went, nope, this is saying there's a good probability we're going to get it.
Yeah.
Now, let's spray now. So that was pretty helpful to do that. The one other odd part with tar spot that I think is flared up at times is its long latency period or latent period. So meaning that from when it infects to when you visually do see it is quite long compared to other diseases. It's 14 to 21 days. So
it's
basically
like the shingles virus that's already inside you.
It's there. It's festering.
But no, in that way, it is kind of similar to white mold, where once you see the white mold, it's already too late. Like, it's been there.
Right.
And other plants are infected, you just can't see it yet because they haven't.
That's been one of the struggles with scouting for it, is you're basically scouting for what happened 2 to 3 weeks ago, and then you're going to decide to spray right then, which what I have seen, though, in general, is if you do see it and then spray right away, it does seem like you can sort of like stop the bleeding. Like it's not curative. Like it's not going to stop what's there, but it's preventative enough that it seems like it does seem to hold
and
well.
And you can't stop the bleeding with white mold, right? Like
that's
already done. And that's how many times do we have those conversations with farmers? Like, okay, it's time to spray for white mold. Nah, I don't want to do it. It's too expensive, whatever the reasons are. And then we get white mold and we're like, well, what are you going to do about it? Or what do you want to do? And it's like, we had this talk a month ago and we didn't want to. So at least here, like you said, Todd, you can stop the bleeding. Yep, you can't prevent what you see, but you can prevent from making it worse at that point.
Even this year, I did have some where it was silage corn that got sprayed fairly early, so it was like VT, like right as the tassels were coming out, because we wanted to sort of be ahead of it. And then what was crazy is, like 3 weeks after spraying it, we saw tar spot, and went like, well, we sprayed this, so obviously it was just being, and again, I ran tar spotter, it says it was a high chance, so we sprayed it. And that is one tricky part, too, is so when you do spray one time, and then you scout for it and see it, you got to decide, like, was this sort of already here in the infection, or wasn't it? And it does seem like those, because that was about 2 weeks ago that we saw it come in, and they haven't gotten any worse, really. So it did seem like the fungicide did what it was supposed to do and help it.
So, yeah, I think overall, what are the takeaways, Bill, then, that what's changed? Has anything changed really in a couple of, you know, 2-3 years since we've talked about this last time?
And yeah, I don't think anything has changed. We just probably know more and we're able to understand it a little bit better. The first part is understand your corn, right? Let's now we're getting to that point where
to your corn. Its ears are out there.
It's listening. The seed salesmen are going to be back out in force, right, in another month
or
so. So we're again back in that cycle of picking hybrids for next year. So understand your corn.
We have gotten that, like we just said, there's way more ratings than there was.
Yeah.
You know, so what have we learned? We learned that it's good to have a rating so you know how good or bad it's going to be. You know where you can maybe put fungicide or not because of that. A lot of times, like in this area, we grow a lot of BMR corn. All that is getting fungicide. It's just an automatic now. And it was an automatic before tar spotting, and now it's even more of an automatic because of that. So I think Bill's right of knowing that weakness or strength in your hybrids, very important.
Scout, still want to scout, because like you said, Todd, yep, you see it, you can't stop that, but we can say, well, do we want to, here's where the corn stage is at, do we want to keep going? And then I think we've learned that if you time it right, you probably don't need two applications. One is probably enough if we hit that somewhere between tassel to R3 stage, which we're kind of right there right now. And I think it depends what you're using. Are you using a ground rig? Then you have more control over that. Even the drone guys, I feel like you have more control when they get there.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
The planes, we have zero.
It's just,
It seems like, oh, we're coming this week, and then it's next week, and then we're coming this week, and then it's week after. It just seems like they're never on time.
The product you're using also matters in that. I mean, more of these fungicides now have more than one active ingredient. Yeah,
multiple modes of action.
Yeah. So if you're just using a sort of a, maybe like a headline, let's just say that. If you're just using a one mode of action, you might need a second application, or might not do as good of a job, or say it's later in that when you are spraying that you're closer to R2, maybe you can just use the one mode of action because you're already later in the season. But a lot of these products now have, you know, two modes of action that do a very good job on it because you got sort of that multiple defense.
Some of the literature says leave a check strip, but I know that's hard to do because you don't want the check strip to get super infected, and then you got low yields in that check strip. But
it
is an area you can do to just to verify yourself.
And you're leaving infected residue in the field. And
right.
That one is a tricky one with this. I would agree. You know, when you're doing a check strip for, say, a fertilizer treatment or a variety or something like that, you're not potentially affecting other things with this.
Right.
Yes, you could be leaving an infection point too that gets infected and then moves out. But you still got to learn whether it worked or not. So maybe it's just using it appropriate. Maybe it's not a full strip. Maybe it's a section of the field, or you know,
to have the plane do a test strip on your neighbor's field.
Yeah, right. That'd be the other part. Is sometimes it ain't bad is to pick a field you weren't gonna put the fungicide on and go do one strip through that field to see if it helped or not. Last year, there was a guy that used the drone and wrote, did it pay? He left, that was an exclusionary. So he left out the did it pay. Do you guys remember that? Or we talked about it on TTR. Yeah, it was cool. So he sprayed the whole field with the drone fungicide, but then had it lead off in the letters to spray did it pay. And you could literally read those letters in the air photo. So it was really neat to see. Yeah. So stuff like that It is neat to see, but maybe, like I said, a better way to do it is if you have a field or a variety that you know, is stronger on it and you're not going to put the fungicide on, maybe you have the plane or the drone or a ground rig go sneak in and make one pass through it to see did that pay or not.
One neat thing with some of my growers was we had to, this was kind of a higher Western bean cutworm year too.
Certain areas. An earworm.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of the pro farmer crop tours going on right now, and they're finding earworm we've seen.
So we, you know, it's that whole, like, throw it in and you're going over it. But this year it actually worked out to our advantage that a lot of those fields we were going to spray anyway with fungicide, we timed out so that we could get those Western bean cutworms, and it seemed like that's paying off too.
Bill, you're right, are having the moth traps out for Western bean cutworm. We saw weeks that corresponded with when we were spraying fungicide of very high moth count, you know, in the 200 moth counts, and you could say, okay, and then scouting for eggs and finding them and going, the piggybacking does work there.
Yeah.
All right. Well, in case you're curious, the product guides that we've seen so far for 2025 that will have tar spot ratings, Dairyland, Rank, NK, and LG all have them. And I think for the most part, as you're, because picking your varieties, it does get so early, like we talked, looking across your fields now and getting a feel for what has tar spot, what, how bad is it, can help that decision for next year. Because obviously, if you have a really susceptible variety, you probably don't want to plant that again next year. So, all right, now we'll move into our spotlight for today. So the battle for milk supplies is likely to grow. Makes it sound like American Gladiators out there. You got the milk plant, like, up on the pedestal with the big dumbbell-looking thing.
Q-tip.
So milk supplies, as they tighten, milk prices rise, and cheese manufacturing capacity expands, but more milk dryers could run light. So cheese processors are typically willing to pay extra for milk to keep their vats full, but non-fat dry milk manufacturers depend on cheap milk during times of surplus, according to Serena Sharp, an analyst with the Daily Dairy Report. So in the absence of excess milk, like we are seeing today, the combined production of non-fat dry milk and skim milk powder tends to lag the production of other dairy products. For instance, January through June, combined output of non-fat dry milk and skim milk powder declined 15.2% compared to the same period a year earlier. If dairy producers continue to struggle to boost milk production and capacity, processing capacity expands as expected, U.S. milk powder production could continue to decline while output of butter and cheese expands. So yeah, not something you really think about. The dry powder milk side, but that is still being affected by milk prices and milk demand, milk production. So it's kind of funny how some of those things go opposite directions, like more cheese, but less dry milk.
It's just nice to see somebody battling for milk. Like,
right.
Actually want it.
No, I remember as a kid, Bill, where the milk plant field man, where like other milk plants field man would come out and try to, you know, there was someone would battle there for to try to get your milk, you know, and I don't remember it. It wasn't battles, maybe a strong word.
Right.
It was a sales visit. Like, hey, you know, if you come with us in the last 10 years,
here's
that,
this nice cooler.
Yeah, right. Yes, you're right. Usually you got a.
It's almost the other way around now, right? Like the farmers are.
You had to go find your field man and try to. Yeah.
Milk truck shows up every
day. Right. Whereas this shows that, you know, there's that demand there for it again. And hopefully the field man's got to, you know, got to work with the farmer a little bit better to get the milk.
All right. Now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. So, speaking of milk, in 1933, Wisconsin had the milk strikes. So, as the effects of the 1929 Wall Street crash and the Great Depression rippled through the United States, many working-class Americans felt the economic impact, including Wisconsin farmers. Midwestern farmers were already suffering before the Depression. And since Wisconsin served as the nation's leading producer of many different dairy products, the livelihoods of many farmers and workers depending on the dairy industry. However, yearly average price received by Wisconsin farmers for milk dropped from $2.01 in 1929 to 89 cents. In 1932, a decrease of 56% in just 3 years. Farmers could barely afford to cover their production costs for dairy products and felt that demands were not being heard by Wisconsin state officials. Angry and desperate at the decreasing price of that they were receiving, many Wisconsin farmers, producers, and shippers joined a series of three strikes in 1933, known as the Wisconsin milk strikes. In order to alleviate the burden by the Depression, farmers and producers began participating in local and statewide cooperatives. These organizations merged independent rural producers into large collective structures, which also served as political advocacy groups for farmers' rights. Many cooperatives helped lead the strikes, especially the Wisconsin Milk or Cooperative Milk Pool, led by President Walter M. Singler. The Milk Pool, formed in 1932, is a statewide organization, and Singler quickly gained a reputation for charisma, powerful appearance, and fiery debate style. While the Milk Pool had a much smaller membership than its contemporaries, Singler's energy and determination quickly solidified them as an important labor organization. For many farmers, Singler's confident rhetoric was magnetic. The farmers most impacted by the Depression were small producers, mostly located in eastern Wisconsin. These farmers could not afford the cost of production for milk and felt neglected and unheard by Wisconsin and federal governments. On February 8, 1933, Singler and the Milk Pool leadership voted to launch a statewide strike. That was the first of the three. And so over time, they did actually see an increase in price because of the strikes, but it quickly went kind of the other way after a little while. So eventually, counties instituted restrictions and punishments. Only 19 counties of the 71 in Wisconsin completely closed for delivery of milk as a result of the strikes. Despite these obstacles, the Milk Pool did persevere and organized mass protests and strikes across the state. So
it's cool seeing them. Like, some of these where they had to call a National Guard in on some of the raids of milk plants and shipments and stuff.
Yep,
and
they're
dumping in barrels.
So eventually, even though the strikes didn't really solve the problem, the New Deal came in, passed by President Franklin D. Roosevelt, and helped improve the farmer standard of living. So there you go.
Yeah, that'd be quite a, if you're the milk truck driver and you got to worry about somebody
crossing picket lines.
Yeah, coming to get you and running off the road. And it does say some of the counties that were most, Shawnee County, Outagamie, Waukesha, which I thought were interesting, three counties where there was more violence and
have a picture in the article here of National Guard walking through tear gas in Shawnee. Yeah.
Good. Thank you, Matt. And thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe and tell a farmer friend. If you are on an iPhone, just search Tilth Talk Radio on Apple Podcasts, and you'll be able to find us out there. If you're on the Green Bubble. Thank you, Matt. The Green Bubble phone on an Android, you'll have to find an app. Podcast Addict, or it's YouTube Music now is another one. All you need to do there is also search Tilth Talk Radio. You can also listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Just go to tilthag.com/podcasts. And you can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks, Todd. Now we'll do our Cool Beans, That's Corny, and some current events. So Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans. Our Cool Beans this week is literally Cool Beans.
Sweet.
A new soybean yield record set at 218 bushel.
So soybeans.
That's what I said. New soybean yield record.
Yes, not corn.
That's a lot of cool beans.
Yeah. Yes. So Georgia farmer Alex Harrell crushed his own previous record of 206 bushel. He's shattered the world record yield with bin busting 218.2856 bushel per acre average. Not only has he broken his own record, but he's done it in back-to-back years. 34-year-old farmer he's farming 4,000 acres with his father, Rodney, in Lee and Sumter counties north of Albany, Georgia, not New York. He raises corn, soybeans, wheat, and watermelons, and farms to push yield on every acre. For 2024, he was planting Pioneer's new Z series, P49Z02E, on single 30-inch rows with a seeding rate of 110,000 seed per acre and a final stand of 105,000 plants. So it's not like he's planting 180,000 or 140,000 even. So it's actually fairly low populations for beans. And he said he was impressed with what he saw, increased his stand rate from last year because last year he saw too much gapping and some of the branches breaking off, and so he thought if he kind of modified that, he'd get some better yield, and it looks like it paid off. So
that's a lot.
Yeah.
What does that even look like on?
Yeah, just the picture. I mean, they look thick and crazy, but not nothing. I don't know. They look fine. In waist high beans, but just full of pods. I mean, full of pods looks like a lot of branching. A lot of like looks like three or four, you know, big pods as well. A 4-9 bean, it'd be
right,
you know.
Right. We're not even there's in that no stratosphere.
Yeah,
here.
I mean, we're less than half of that. Which it's so it, to the analogy of like, say they probably plant 120-day corn. We don't plant 60-day corn. No, you know, it's right. We're a little higher. So yes, when we're talking like a 2-0 bean versus a 4-9. That's not a real,
and you're determinant versus indeterminate. Yeah,
it'd be like a right. It'd be like a heavyweight wrestler wrestling against your what I don't know, what are they at? They're not 103 pounders anymore. It's like a
no,
because
they added like 205 and the
yeah. What yeah, they're whatever the new weight classes are. For yeah. One. So yes, it wouldn't be the same. Not that we can't learn things from how they grow them. I think it is interesting, Matt, that they're at 110,000, not the 140. So,
and it is again kind of like a national corn growers plot. We're not talking 40 acres right. Here. It was 2.5 acres or 2.58, harvested August 13th. So, you know, different area, different growing season, different length of bean. So a lot of things different from here in Wisconsin, but still pretty cool that he was able to do it. And what I thought was cool too is they had a 5-bean pod.
Really?
They had a picture of
5-beaner?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I think that maybe was more like the plant itself maybe didn't look different, but having
well, right.
A lot of 4 and 5 beans potentially, you know, instead of threes.
That adds a lot.
Makes a big difference, yeah.
What I was surprised, they got one where they dug it up and have the roots intact. And the root itself, at first glance, does not look like anything impressive. Yeah. But you do look at the tap part of the root, so where that would be the thicker part, and it's big. It looks like bigger, you know, like the stem diameter is, you know, not it's
more closer to your thumb than your pinky.
Well, it'd be huger than that. It's like the size of like almost like your wrist, you know, like it just looks massive. And then the tap down looks like, you know, most of ours are like baby carrot size. This looks like a regular real carrot, like if you put a real carrot and added some roots to it. So
sure.
Pretty impressive that way.
Yeah. All right. That's corny this week. EPA is probing biodiesel supply for potential fraud. The Biden administration is following the paper trails of some biodiesel producers amid heightened concern that the fuels are at times being made with deceptive ingredients that violate federal law. The action by the EPA comes as farm groups and a growing number of lawmakers press the government to address worries that cooking oil, or UCO, used cooking oil, a valuable ingredient for making renewable fuels, could be fraudulent. The audits seek to track the sources of UCO, according to people familiar with the matter. Probes reported earlier by Reuters follow a wave of UCO coming from China that is flooding the U.S. market and undercutting producers of American-grown feedstocks, such as soy or corn oil. EPA spokesman described the inspections as part of a routine evaluation of compliance with U.S. biofuel policy. And the concern is that the UCO coming from Asia may not be authentic and is instead mixing fresh vegetable oil, such as palm oil, into the mix, making it different from what it should be. And palm oil is one of the world's most widely used vegetable oils. It's a bane to environmentalists in many countries because the industry is tied to labor abuses and a key driver of deforestation in places like Indonesia. So somebody's mixing fresh oil with the used oil, and apparently that's an issue. So now we'll wrap things up with our Feel Good Friday. And that's a record-breaking $25,000 bid for a ham that pushes the Wisconsin Meat Products auction sales to $130,000 total. The record-breaking bid was on the Best of Show Bone-In Ham at the Governor's Blue Ribbon Meat Products Auction at the Wisconsin State Fair. Auction features the best-in-class meat products from processors around Wisconsin, and helps raise funds for Wisconsin 4-H Foundation, which supports 4-H activities, including conferences, teaching materials, and workshops, as well as the overall development of 4-H youth. Enthusiastic 4-H supporters made for an exciting evening, said Wisconsin 4-H Foundation Executive Director Brenda Scheider. Seeing our 4-H youth and adult volunteers working next to our generous donors really brings home what 4-H is all about. So RJ's Meats of Hudson was this year's recipient of the 2024 Dennis Bouge Best of Show Award for its entry in the bone-in ham division. The ham was sold to a consortium of Johnsonville Sausage, Badger State Auction, Bill Thompson, Merwin Farms, Adams Farms, Wilson Meat Farm Meats, and Kathy Bouge for $25,000. They've also had some bacon, dried beef, summer sausage, ring sausage, snack sausage, bratwurst, specialty cured meat products. Wisconsin's specialty item as a category. And yeah, brought in the total of $130,000 at the auction. So pretty cool.
It's a lot of ham.
That's cool, yeah.
That is, yeah. You wonder how big of a ham we're talking. Like,
well, the guy in the picture there in the back's got it.
Yes. Maybe hanging there. I don't know about you, but I can't tell weight by
no.
the front face is part of a ham.
No. Yeah.
It's not small.
It doesn't,
though.
No.
No.
It does not look abnormally large either. But yeah, so good for them. All right. Well, that'll do it for this week. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
So today we talked about tar spot and some of the things we've learned over the years and considerations for fungicide applications. In our spotlight, we looked at the battle for milk supplies as supply is making changes in milk price changes as well. Ag History Minute, the Wisconsin milk strikes of 1933. Cool beans this week was new soybean yield record of 218 bushel. That's Corny was EPA probing potential fraud in biodiesel supply. And our Field Good Friday was a record-breaking $25,000 bid for a bone-in ham at the Wisconsin Governor's Meat Product Auction. Thanks for listening, and as always, happy farming.